thank you for joining us. My name is Tom Benton. I'll kick off our Grand Junction Regional Airport Authority meeting on March 15th. It is 5:15. I'd like to call the meeting to order. And part of that process was, would you join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
That sounds like a nightmare.
I'd like to recognize our commissioners are here present this evening. Thank you all for taking the time to join us. We are missing Commissioner Taggart, who is under the weather this evening, so not going to be able to join us. I would also like to recognize our guests that are here today. Colin Bible, thank you for being here. I think you have a compatriot here, Mario. Mario with you as well. Mario, welcome. Glad to have you here. Brian Moore and Josh Cohn from InterBusiness. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your attendance. Jeremy Lee over there. Jeremy, thank you for joining us as well. And I think we have Dan Reimer. Yep, Dan's on the phone, our counsel for the Airport Authority. And I think Todd Green's here as well from CDOT. Thank you, Todd, for joining us. Staff, let's see. Do you want to call out staff that are present today?
Yes, I'd love to. We have Executive Director Angela Padalecki, Director of Operations Dylan Heberlein, Director of Facilities Ben Peck, Director of Finance Sarah Mingy, Accounting Coordinator Shayla Flesh, and myself, Cameron Reese, Board Clerk.
Thank you, Cameron. Appreciate that. Attendance has been called. All right, so our agenda this evening, we have five items on the consent agenda, two of which are minutes from February 15th and March 1st. We have the NOT Laboratory Scope of Work, Memorandum of Understanding from CDOT, for camera installation, and also our airport goals that we've discussed at previous meetings. That's, and our action item is approval of our Executive Director's Employment Contract Amendment, which includes a compensation change and minor changes to the employment agreement. The discussion, our InterBusiness update, and then staff reports. So I'll entertain a motion to approve the agenda as presented, or does anybody wish to pull items from the consent?
So moved.
Very good. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same side. Motion carries. Thank you. All right. Commissioner comments this evening. Anybody have something they wish to report?
No.
Okay. Appreciate the staff, everybody in the operations department taking care of our visitors who are going in and out of the airport for their practice session. So thank you, Bill. Keeping them fueled along the way. Do you have anything for your team for just general comments or
no changes to the agenda, no general comments.
Okay, very good. Do we have any public comments this evening?
Mr. Chairman, we do not have any citizen comments tonight.
Okay. Thank you. Cameron, appreciate that. That said, entertain a motion to approve the consent agenda as prepared this evening.
So moved.
Thank you, Rilla. Is there a second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same side. Motion carries. Very good. Our first action item on the agenda is to approve the amendment, the proposed amendment to the Executive Director's Employment Contract. I think you all have a copy of that that was delivered earlier as a result of our meetings that we've had and the review of Angela's performance. I think it's been reviewed by your executive team, Clay, I, and legal counsel. You've also seen that before. As it relates, there was one minor change. We changed the date effectiveness from January 8th to January 1st because all the staff are reviewed on the first of each year for their changes. So that's one modification. Any discussion on this item this evening before we get started? Okay. I guess I'd just summarize briefly some of our comments. Angel, we know it takes a team to accomplish what you've been able to do this last year. We're very grateful for your team and what the team you put together. It also takes leadership to execute, and the board's very much in approval and appreciative of what you've been able to do along this line. So thank you for that. I guess it entertain a motion to approve the amendment.
So moved.
Second. Is there a second? Thank you. Further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Very good. Pose same sign. Motion carries. Thank you all. I want to really extend my appreciation to the commissioners on this. You guys did a marvelous job in sending in comments for the performance review, so thank you for your time.
And thank you, Tom, for leading it, because I know it's a lot of work, and you took the time to interview direct reports, and so thank you for coordinating this.
Absolutely. All right. Next item on our agenda is discussion for the airport development plan and the business. Brian, your team, and Josh.
Thanks for having us this evening. I think when we started back in July, we talked about having some answers in the early part of the year and into the spring, and I'm happy to say that we have a few tonight, and we continue to raise new questions about some of those answers, and new answers will be still forthcoming. But we are getting to a place where we're starting to draw development plans up and evaluate those development plans, so we'll jump in. So two topics tonight, terminal alternatives and parking alternatives. When we're talking about terminal here, we're talking about the building we're sitting in at this moment. What are the things that we need to do to grow the terminal to serve the demand that we expect over the 20-year planning horizon? We do look beyond 20 years just to inform the next 20 years, and then we look even shorter term into the next 5 and 10. And then we'll talk about automobile parking on the airport, which is so important for the airport to fund its future improvements, provide a passenger amenity that is required, and we'll go through that. And Josh is going to take us through the terminal alternatives, and please let him know if you have any questions. I guess before we do that, as I mentioned, we are kind of getting to the point where we're drawing pictures, and so the star sort of represents where we're at here in March. We hoped in April to be doing alternatives formulation and evaluation. We're sort of about 2 months ahead of schedule in terms of where we're at in the process, because we're already evaluating the alternatives, and we have a couple of draft preferred alternatives, what I would call them. We'll run them by you, certainly get feedback from you. Eventually, we'll run them by the technical advisory committee that we met with today and get their feedback, and of course, we're getting authority feedback as we go. So with that, I think the next one, this one, go for it.
Thanks, Brian. So this is my favorite part, obviously, drawing terminals and thinking about the footprint. And so to do this, we really wanted to make sure we left no stone unturned in terms of thinking about how we grow from where you are today to something much larger, as we've talked about in previous meetings. And so to do this, we took three approaches, and we'll go through at a very high level what those three look like. We'll jump to the preferred alternative, but we're happy to look at any of the other alternatives as well in more detail if that's of interest. But the three ways we looked at this, the first one on the top left that we're calling the concourse parallel option, this is what has historically been in the previous master plan and on the airport layout plan. This is a sort of a single loaded where planes are on one side, just working your way kind of from east to west across your current apron. The one in the middle is, it looks a little funny there, the little finger in the green there sticking up, but this is our thought process on a perpendicular concourse, so using the area you have between the terminal building and the future runway and the taxiway and the existing runway. Can we load airplanes on two sides of a concourse, get better use of the concourse we have in terms of the width, improve walking distances, things like that? And then on the far right, we have what we call the T-pier concourse, and that's a little bit of experimentation into how we can utilize that depth. Is there a reason we should push the gates further out onto the apron? Does that help with loading the airplanes? Does that help with construction, anything like that? And so we investigated that as well.
Josh, if I could just stop, because Angela helped us with this slide before, because we presented it as you did.
Yeah.
But the gray that we're showing, that really that represents airfield pavement. That's apron pavement, where the airplanes park on the concrete. The blue is the building we're sitting in, the terminal. Sometimes we call that the processor. Sometimes we call that the head house, but that is the ticket lobby, the baggage claim, the office that we're sitting in presently. That's what we refer to as the processor. The green that Josh is showing in the dashed line would be future concourse space, which would be passenger hold rooms, we call them sometimes, or departure lounges where you're waiting to board your airplane.
Would it extend out into the grassy area, or is that just a two scale?
It would.
It would.
So we'll show you a better picture.
Yeah, so there, yeah, there's a possibility of filling in the orders. So as we think about the concourse and the terminal as a whole, we first start with this sort of ultimate view of what it will look like in the very long-term future, and then we work our way backwards to 20 years to 10 years to make sure that as we put together a plan, we can phase into each of those. And so what you're seeing there in the green will look a little different when we show you the bigger pictures, but we want to make sure that we take into account kind of how we phase into that. There's a series of sort of geometric planning rules that we use, make sure that we are picking an appropriate aircraft size, that we provide space for ground service vehicles, the roadway, the VSR, the vehicle service road behind it, that it works with the taxiway configuration. So all of that is embedded in each of these alternatives to make sure that we are providing a facility that does provide the highest and best use. When we get into the phasing on the right, the square on the right there with the three gray, blue kind of ish colors, we'll show you four phases. The first one, this enabling phase of phase zero, this will be consistent with all of the plans, and that's to give you some additional capacity right out the window here above the loading dock. That's what, and the bag, the first makeup unit that's down there. To give you some more capacity where the TSA checkpoint is for a larger checkpoint for some hold room space down in the kind of the gate one, gate six area. From there, we show a phase of five boarding bridge enabled gates. That sort of gets you into the 5 year horizon, or 5 to 10 year horizon. A phase two, which gets you to seven boarding bridges. That's pretty close to what the 20 year program looks like. And then we go one step further, just again to kind of show you what the next piece would look like. That's not quite all the way to the ultimate development plan.
And you see the word lollipop there. We use the term lollipop. It's a technical term.
Yes.
For the stub of concourse that's shown in blue, where people board today, where the concession is at the end of that space. So that we
place with
looking,
the bar.
Yeah, it's got a bar and a concession. And we are always looking, as Josh said, to maintain the existing operation while you phase into the new one. And so we talk about the lollipop as a reference.
Yes.
I'm just trying to think if we could get any more acronyms involved, but PBB again. Is
yeah, that's what I've been saying.
Passenger boarding bridge.
Yeah.
My favorite thing is that we simultaneously use highly technical terms you don't know what they mean
with
really rudimentary slang to make sure that no one ever truly understands everything we're talking about.
We teach airport planning as we do this. Yeah. So we're going to dive right into what we are sort of working toward in terms of a preferred alternative, and this is what we're showing as an ultimate build. So this is significantly more gates than you will need in that planning period. In fact, I think we have 15 of them on the image here, which is well beyond maybe a 50 or 60 year look ahead. But we really wanted to show what this could turn into if you go down the path of the perpendicular option. So you can see the head house, the existing head house in the gray in the sort of bottom right there with the fans. Yeah, thank you.
The terrace,
thank you, yes. We'll get into each of the phases, but the orange was is the phase zero, the little rectangle, and then there are concourse expansions in the green and the blue. The other thing we wanted to highlight about what's interesting about this option is the white sort of trapezoid rectangle to the left with the chamfer there, yeah, more technical terms. This is how we think about, you know, a space for a future head house when you are that far down the road and you've outgrown where we are today in terms of the need for ticket counters and bag claim units and things like that. This option allows you to, one, recenter the head house on this U, but also give you more space and a place to build it while you're still living in your current head house. So we like the flexibility that this plan offers. The other nice thing about this is with the dual loaded concourses, it is a smaller footprint than a single loaded linear pier that runs out in both directions. Which has its benefits for concessions and walking distances and restrooms and other facilities that you would plan out on those piers.
Yeah, and if I could just dwell on that a moment.
Yeah.
If we were to draw 15 airplanes parked linearly, as it was done in the last master plan, it's a fine plan, but that those 15 gates would stretch past where FedEx currently parks the airplane and up to where Twin Otter has their facilities today, so it's a bigger land grab and doesn't really take advantage of any of the depth of apron. So that's one of the reasons we like this. Another reason we like it is it's less building space for more airplanes, which sounds sort of bad because you don't want to sit in a departure hold room that's undersized. But there is an efficiency. That concourse that is double loaded or has airplanes on both sides is not twice the width of a single loaded concourse. It's more like 1.5 to 1.75, 1 3/4 times the width. So for that reason, you know, this is just a better, it's a better experience in terms of the walking distance to the extent of the pier. After you've gone through security, you're not going that far. If you are Tailwind Concessions or you're a concessionaire, you like having more airplanes in a compact space because there's more people to partake in the concessions, and so everybody sort of wins in this type of scenario. So for those reasons, plus the ability to eventually someday say 50 years from now or 40 years from now, depending on the circumstances, or even 30 years from now, if you had built out some of that, some or all of that concourse, you would be looking at this facility saying, boy, that is really getting hard to re-life. The systems are failing and there's a lot of unforeseen maintenance that's being required. Then you would be able to tear this building down after you've built something new to replace it. Mm-hmm. And that is a huge advantage that most airports do not have the luxury of. Normally they're hemmed in by facilities that are hard constraints. And in this particular case, this just works really well, enabling that to occur when it needs to. So.
Is it also a selling point? It reminds me of, this is not a great example, but DIA has different concourses for different airlines. Is it a selling point for the airlines to have like this wing that they could have only to themselves and then the green wing, let's just say, for another airline?
I think you should.
Yeah, and you gave a great example this morning.
Well, I don't know which example you're talking about.
If we get to the phasing, I think maybe.
You know, the answer is they can, yeah. Right? So, you know, with this, right now, these are all cartoon airplanes that are white, right? So it's agnostic to airline. And that's where, from any perspective, it's nice because you can see how this would work no matter who's flying. To answer your question, you know, airlines, product differentiation is a huge part of their business, right? And so anytime they can set up shop and have, you know, implement their standards, if we were building this, we're the size of airport where they're going to really care about doing that. Right now, you know, we have all common use gates and, you know, there's flexibility. Granted, they want to make sure that they can use their updated logo, things like that, but there's less of a need for them to be, you know, highly efficient with their space, for one, or in control of that. The other thing is, I think right now, maybe this is what you're talking about, when you look at the mix we have, the fleet mix we have, it is the airline mix we have, what we anticipate in the future, we have hubbing carriers who fly regional jets. We think that's really important because we care about frequency. And so we want them to fly lots of small airplanes, so we have lots of options. Mm-hmm. And then we also have high density narrow bodies. So when it comes to the spectrum of airplane, you know, we have Frontier who's flying twice a week, but you know, it's an Airbus with 180 seats on it. That, from a facility perspective, you know, creates different demands than the 50-seat RJ that's going back and forth to Denver five times a day, right? And then we have the spectrum in there. So this provides this opportunity that as the airline, you know, as we see growth, we can build to solve the problems we're facing at that time. Because right now, we're facing a problem, for example, and that's where, you know, with this yellow or orange box, you know, during peak times, we have a hold room space problem. Because of Allegiant and Frontier flying out at the same time, it's a lot of people out there. This is set up as a regional terminal. And so, you know, creating more square footage, we need more square footage more than we need another gate.
What would happen to the hangars then? Like Gateway and Westar, would you just take them down and relocate them, or how would that be part of the plan?
I think as we
go ahead.
Since this is in the long term, I think we would have to look at how far west that blue pier goes, and it's possible that those two hangars may need to be relocated, along with FedEx on the right hand side at some point to enable these.
But we are zoomed way in here, yeah. In the Westar facilities for the most part, with setting aside the facility to the west. They're unaffected to the east.
Oh, so it's not necessarily to scale?
Are you talking about this Westar hangar or like?
Yeah, that one.
So that one is not shown on here. But ultimately,
that's that one there, isn't it?
Planning horizon, yeah. This is not within, not only is this not within our 20-year planning horizon, but, you know, roughly based on current forecasts, when would this show up?
2060,
probably 50-ish years.
And so that's where, as we were approaching that, because this will get built in a phased way,
right,
as we were approaching that, we'd be preparing. And so, you know, 40 years from now, we might be, you know, really looking at and saying, I don't know if we can extend, you know, I don't know if we can approve a lease for that building for another 30 years because we think we might need it in 10. So as we got into that planning window,
right,
we make those decisions.
And the geometry is such in there that positions 8 and 9, you might not have 9, and you could suck that back to the east a little bit more and not impact those other hangars.
Yeah, we have sort of widely spaced parking positions around the concourse, and I think one of the most interesting things that some of us heard at the conference the other day, and we hear from Boeing, we had actually missed the call with Boeing yesterday, Josh, but we do a monthly call with Boeing. And one of the things that they've been talking a lot about is they are building an aircraft that has folding wings. And the reason is that they are looking to try to, the longer the wingspan gets, the better range the aircraft gets, the more fuel efficient it gets. And so what they're talking about is that, you know, this very large airplane, the 747s and the Airbus A380s are sort of out of vogue. Airlines are not that interested in those airplanes
anymore. They're too big.
They are too big. But what airlines really are interested in is something that holds a couple hundred people or less, but can go very, very far. So they're looking at these folding wing airplanes so that they can pull them up to the gate and not have them interrupt the next gate over. So what we're starting to hear increasingly is the future airplanes that we're designing might have longer and longer wingspans, but not carry any more people. And there's only so much that they can do with folding wings to account for the physics of it all. And it's very interesting, and it made us think, you know, while concourses aren't going to get that much bigger to hold that much more people, these planes are changing, the design of the planes are changing. And I'm not saying that we are expecting that in the horizon here, but I think it is possible that the planes will need to be spaced a little bit more generously, which solves another problem, which is just if you don't have a lot of depth for your concourse, you can still provide a reasonable experience because you're going to have a longer building. So there are those uncertainties, especially when we're looking out to 2070. When we're talking about 2030, you know, we're thinking, you know, 7 to 9 parking positions. So you could think about everything west, say, of position 9 there, 10 through 15, being something quite a far out there in the future, unless you are fortunate and you have explosive growth 10 years from now because of something that's occurred in the market, which is certainly possible.
And we can jump into the phasing, kind of show how we get there, if that kind of frames it up a little bit here. Weird.
She's zoomed in.
Oh, what happened there? So what we're showing here is the final iteration of this. We have gone through, both Brian and I and others, and then with the authority, ways of looking at how we get out to the 9 or so gates. And one of the things we learned about and we explored during our discussions with the authority was, if we build out to the left, sort of in the blue direction there first, that really enables us to keep a lot of the operation existing today. Right now you've got the 3 ground loaded positions. I think they're off gate 6 today, out A, B, and C. By keeping those available, it allows you to do the work on the left side of the concourse, build new hold room, get those new jet bridges, and not seriously impact the operation. And so we've rephased this to focus a little bit on the left-hand side first after you do the orange block. And then from there, once you've built that capacity up, you can then go back to the right-hand side where the ground-loaded gates are and build the little kind of green arm that sticks out there, and that gets you up to 6 positions. And then to take it to the final step, there's the light green rectangle in phase 3 that'll get you the last 3 positions and gets you out to 9 boarding bridge-enabled gates.
And that's, okay.
I was going to say, and what we've made sure in each of these phases is you get to a point where you can stop, still operate the airport, not have any sort of major impacts to each of these phases, where if you have to live in phase 2 for 5, 10, 15 years, you can do that comfortably. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, I was just going to say, and the comment was raised earlier, are we filling in the ovals and parking the airplane on the grass, or what are we doing? I think when the new runway opens, you can fill that oval in and get that depth out of the apron and still have a taxi lane easily, two taxi lanes on the end of that. certainly look at that, and you would. So any of these phases, I think the temptation will be when you're designing it that you're providing this much square feet, and you could look at it and say, well, I want to go just a little bit more because I actually expect one more airplane than I thought when I formulated this plan back in 2021 for 2022.
I think you on phase three with the tail of airplane eight would be encroaching upon the setbacks to use it as a taxiway. Taxi lane, not so much, but a taxiway. I think you would be too close, especially when you push back. But I mean, those are way things
out
in the
future. I think taxi lane alpha group four, I think, is where we settled at right now, but just as a line in the sand, but we can certainly look at the different dimensions of that.
We have drawn this in AutoCAD
with
all the dimensions, making sure that we're good. It's not where these pictures look sort of graphical, but we have done it in plan view to make sure that we're good from a perspective of all the FAA safety.
And getting the DSR in there and all that.
Okay.
I think
we'll turn our attention to the parking then. So this is what pays for all of those improvements over time. The airlines like to think that they pay for all of it, but it's really people parking, and it is the airlines. They're the other half of the equation. But the parking requirements, I just want to point out on the right, the graph that's shown there, on the x-axis, EPAX is enplanements. So one-way passengers going out. So we have three planning activity levels for this study. And planning activity level three, for example, is the third bar from the right at 500,000 enplanements. We would expect that to occur sometime around or after 2040, 2045. So that's pretty far out in the future. About 25 years from now, you would need between 1,200 and 1,700 parking spaces. 1,200 parking spaces to accommodate about 350 to 360 days of the year. 1,700 spaces to get that last few days where you have a boatload of extra passengers. And in your case, it is Thanksgiving. So that's really what we were looking to try to provide. What is the best way to provide as many as 1,700 parking spaces in an efficient manner that can grow and phase and change with time and with people's preferences and the types of cars and all of that? So that's what's shown on this slide. We can go to the next one. And so we drew, I don't know, four or five different ways of providing that parking capacity, including going vertical with a parking garage. But what we were really solving for, is there a compact way to provide this parking without encroaching the space to the east that looks ripe for commercial development, or the space to the south where it says landscaping allowance and post-PAL 3 expansion? All of that space is not necessary for us to use for automobile parking, and we still get out to 1 million passengers or 500,000. And so what we've shown here conceptually is that there is currently an overflow lot where the PAL 1 square is. That is the new parking that you would need to accommodate 300,000 enplanements, which we expect you will hit in the next 5 years. And so prudent planning would say we need to start providing that capacity now. That way, next Thanksgiving or the Thanksgiving after that, you've got all the capacity you need to accommodate that demand, and you're also just a year or two ahead of when you actually need it on a day-to-day basis. So that's sort of the first phase. And that parking lot would be similar to the parking lot to the east where the 668 space label is, in that it would probably be landscaped. There would be landscaping to the north end of that lot with a sidewalk so that passengers don't try to walk across the roadway to get to the terminal. Rather, they would walk east into the other parking lot and on the nice sidewalks that are provided there to get to the crosswalks to the terminal. So that would sort of be the first phase, and I think that's going to be a very quick capital improvement in the CI, in the capital improvement plan. We would have that project in the next fiscal year or two at most. PAL 2 and PAL 3 are shown. You can see that's another big bite of the apple in terms of how much parking to provide. And as you get closer to that and you're watching parking grow, you can make a determination exactly how large that lot needs to be. This is all planned and programmed for just passenger parking. So employee parking is being looked at in another space. It is ideal to keep employees in public cars in different lots. So that's what we're planning. So we are looking at the space remaining, what's the optimal location and amount of employee parking. As we think not just about authority employees, employees that are working in the terminal, but also potentially other tenants, employees like Westar, who have lots and lots of employees, make sure that we can accommodate that demand.
Do you guys use some sort of a metric or data point for the public perception of, oh my God, I gotta walk so far away?
Yes.
And you have to start either bringing a bus in or go vertical.
Yeah.
As soon as you go vertical, the cost mode is incredible, but everybody loves it.
Right.
So where's the crossover there?
That's a great question. So with the walking distance from the PAL 2 and PAL 3 lots, we think of that as a different parking product. So when you're parking further south and you have a slightly longer walk, we think this walk is reasonable.
Sure.
People do this walk and they're okay with it. We're hardy Coloradans, I like to think of. But anyways, we think that that's a reasonable parking, and certainly shuttling would not be necessary. If shuttling were necessary for that distance, we would be talking about a garage. Because the shuttling is something nobody likes. It doesn't pay for itself. It's a very difficult proposition. With regard to the amenity of covered parking, that is on the table, and that is something the authorities asked us to look at. And so we are going to price what it would cost to have canopies. Does it make sense to canopy the entire 668 spaces, or the 668 plus the Powell one, or some central portion of that lot to provide that amenity?
I was actually talking about concrete, and now you're just stacking cars.
Right. You can do that. You can do a parking garage. We don't think a parking garage here is warranted because of the compactness of these lots.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, when you build out PAL 3, you're going to be revisiting that decision. Do we want to go vertical? What's happening with parking demand?
Right.
Are there more autonomous vehicles that are dropping people off and not parking at the airport? Maybe not. We'll see. But I think parking garage is one thing. We think that, again, covered parking, we think, is an amenity you should look at for this market. And it's a relatively straightforward exercise to look at putting canopies over the public parking, how much that costs. We can look at that. The question here that we're asking ourselves is, can we or should we do what Tucson has done and what Albuquerque has done, which is to provide a solar array on top of the canopy? Does that pencil out? Does it make it better? Is it something you simply want to do to try to give back? Or does it actually, you know, improve financial conditions? And how do you best do that? So that's sort of our next step, is to look at covered parking.
That is a really cool idea. And could you not charge a little bit more for the covered parking too, to cover some more amenities?
You could, and the complication is if you cover the entire lot, then yes. If you cover a portion of it, then no.
Gotcha.
So like first come, first serve thing. And you want it to be a pleasant experience where if you go to this parking lot, PAL 2 and PAL 3, our guys call that a nested lot, where you take a ticket and then you take your ticket and you insert it again to get into that other parking lot. That's just the way that it could work today. So to provide different products inside of that, even if you had, like one of the things we've been talking about too, is how many electrical vehicle charging stations do you need? And you
that's
know,
problematic at an airport, because then it's just stuck there for
exactly.
Days.
So you take your Nissan Leaf, and then you pull up to the space, and you go to Italy for 2 weeks.
Right.
That's just how it works. That's how it works at SFO and other airports that have provided some amenity.
Yeah.
They haven't really figured out a way to, you know, say that spot is a premium spot. It costs X more. But we're looking at what is the state of affairs and what are people talking about? How does that work? I think at a minimum, we'll be talking about how many spaces and maybe where, and then scoping some sort of effort for an engineering firm to come in and design that electrical infrastructure to make that happen.
What if you did PAL 2 and PAL 3 as the premium covered parking, so that people are drawn down there and then they want to walk, whatever.
I like that idea. We will ask about that. I think those are interesting things to think about. Those kinds of questions are asked, and our experts aren't with us today who did all this work. I'm sure that they would have some reactions. So we'll get back to you on that.
And I love the solar panels to pay for the electric cars.
I love them. we're still all piling into these huge tubes together. If we don't have Jetson cars by then, I'm out.
40 years, it's like I might not be able to
drive around in huge airplanes. No way. Elon's not doing his job if we're still using very big airplanes.
That's what we have for you. The solar panel question is there, you know, it's not a total slam dunk. There's a few things that we got to look at, but I think we're probably okay. But there's such a thing as a glare study, and that's for the pilots in the room. You'll appreciate this. And again, I'm not a pilot.
Just haven't been flying lately.
if there's glare from those panels, that obviously can affect your aeronautical operation. So we want to make sure that that's okay. Can they be oriented in the right direction? So there are people that have done this work for Tucson and Albuquerque that we know personally. So we're talking to them about how the best way to do this. And every market's different in terms of how this works. One, because if you were in Puerto Rico, the photovoltaic cells would be a no-brainer because electricity is extremely expensive there. If you're here and it's not that expensive, it doesn't look the same financially. Also, different airports pay for electricity differently. Some pay peak period pricing. That also enters into the equation. So there's a bunch of different factors, including how does the federal government feel about your air quality in your region, and are there grant programs associated with that? If your air quality is poor, you can get money for electric vehicles on your airport sometimes. So there's different things we want to work through that we're going to work through in the next few weeks, and maybe a couple of months at most, to come back on all these questions. We got a question.
He says, future plans for moving walkway for pedestrian movement from distant
parking
lots.
Yes.
A
moving walkway
outdoors. Outdoor sidewalks are hard to maintain.
Yeah, unless it's covered.
Unless it's covered, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's where, you know, I think I want to make sure you ask the question, is there a metric for walking distances?
Yeah.
I think Brian went over his process, but the short answer is yes. And actually, this is the only diagram where we don't have these circles.
Yeah, the concentric circles did make it.
The concentric circles to show the walking distances
right.
That informed this. Mm-hmm. So what we're showing you are preferred alternatives,
yeah.
Not an exhaustive set of what was considered. There are metrics. I just don't know that
it's about a fact. So that in the if you take the concentric circles kind of from a baggage claim door from the terminal, almost all of the 668 and most of the PAL 1 are inside 500 feet, which is certainly walkable. The most of PAL 2 and PAL 3 is within 1,000 feet, which is still reasonable. I think once you start to get past that, it becomes a little more complicated because it's not like you can walk 1,000 feet straight to the terminal. You've got to go up the sidewalk over and in. So, but all of these I think are within a comfort level of walking, especially because it's primarily a grade. You're not going up steep slopes and things like that.
Yeah.
One of the things that we've covered in past meetings that I sort of glossed over is just that there is a deterioration between the relationship between passenger growth and parking demand. And not so much in this market at this moment, and that's largely because the Ubers and Lyfts, while active here, are not as active, and your catchment area is large, so people aren't taking an Uber for 4 hours to the airport. But over time, we do expect this to continue to change. And so when we projected parking requirements, I think we had some deterioration in that relationship, but not as much as we would have had if we were doing the parking for SFO, for example, or another highly dense urban area. But we do expect changes in that. And that's why I think, you know, this is our best guess at what's going to be required for, you know, 600,000 passengers. But, you know, you'll just continually revisit this. The good news is, I think, upper bound, we didn't know when we started whether that entire kidney-shaped area to the east was going to be required for parking. This would all be a different discussion, a much harder discussion about how to think about the trade-off between that for that use and another use and the parking garage. But I think those are challenges for down the road.
Thank you, Brian. Josh, any other questions, either on terminal aspects or parking, or kind of where they're headed? So this documentation kind of becomes part of the airport plan that sort of goes upstream to their EDO, FAA, EDO,
yep.
Right?
That's right.
I'm going to begin to get a little bit of vision of what Grand Junction is thinking about for capital needs.
Correct.
Going forward.
Correct.
And the time horizon, is this a 10-year? I forget.
So
the
we're looking looking out 25 years, but we'll have a CIP that looks out 15.
Okay.
A capital improvement program that looks out 15 years.
Certainly, transportation is going to change a fair amount in 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah,
to your point about self-driving, autonomous vehicles,
yeah,
et cetera, it's going to be a reality.
It won't just be cars that are all hybrid. We're talking about what we are going to plan for and what we're going to understand our current situation for, so that we can plan for it as things, you know, come to fruition when it comes to electric vehicles.
I certainly appreciate the presentation this evening, Brian, Josh, as you done.
Thank you.
All right. Any last questions? Okay. We'll move into our staff reports. Angela, thank you for sending out your executive director's report. Nice to see you done. Very thorough. Yeah.
Yes.
It was nice.
Yeah.
Round of applause for Angela.
Oh, it felt good.
Thank you.
It feels good to, have the sun shining and just life getting back to normal, right? So, I'll be brief on my report. Wanted to thank our staff. We have had a lot of diversions lately. You guys know that it's diversion season, but we have had a lot of diversions, especially GA diversions, and I'm really proud of the work that Dylan and his team especially have done in partnering with Westar to make sure that their needs are being met, because they're the ones who are really working to serve all these customers that are coming in as the mountain airports close and things. There have been a few situations where they needed our help with different things in his team. So, wanted to thank them for that. Wanted to let the board know that Intervis's team has been here for a couple of days, and in that time we've met with our general aviation tenants. So we had our quarterly meeting. Erling was there. If he says something nice about it, it's true, and if it wasn't nice, it's not true. No, it really well.
I'm sorry.
It was almost.
But now we know.
I think every seat was filled in the CAF Museum. So we have great engagement right now from our tenants. So we keep them informed on what we're doing, where we're going, get their input, understand their needs. And Dylan has arranged to where the next quarterly general aviation tenant meeting, our CDOT aviation or aeronautics director, Davey Lane, is going to come in and present to that group. So we're really excited about that. You all have met Dave, and virtually, but really excited about that, and just want you all to know that this information is not just coming to you. It's not just being discussed within our team. It's being discussed with the broader group. Today we had our technical advisory committee meeting, and so that includes representatives from really, our goal is all the major stakeholders have representation. The board is not part of that group, and that's deliberate because we want to make sure that they feel as comfortable as possible. So team did a great job with that. But really what I want you to know is that, this information, first of all, the two-way communication is going in both directions, but, at least on this quarterly basis. And thank you to Josh and Brian for being prepared for every meeting along the way to really focus on what's important to that group, because I just think it's a sign of respect. So the last thing I wanted to end with is airline schedules and just, a brief update on that. So airlines have published schedules and made schedule changes that we think are real and represent what they intend to fly as we get into the early summer season. And so it's nice to see stability. We're not going to have the same levels of activity as we had last summer. But we are, only about 10% off compared to 2019. That was a really big summer for us. So we look within the domestic schedule that we're all faring well, and we look for small airports, and when we look regionally, we're faring well as also. So we look very similar to what the airlines are doing at other airports in the region, with the, if you exclude Southwest, because obviously there's a couple of airports in the region that have Southwest, so that's really added on. But otherwise, they're down by 10 to 15% Montrose, Aspen, those types of airports. We're continuing to communicate to our airline partners the types of changes we're seeing in the region, because I'll give you an example. When it comes to going west, we know that there are not as many seats in our market this year as there were in years past, and there's a real shortage with Delta exiting. Also, Americans flying twice a day down to Phoenix, but Americans not flying to Phoenix
until, you know, starting, I think April 4th is the last day they fly to Phoenix from Aspen or Montrose or Eagle. And so when you think about that being plucked out, all of a sudden regionally we have a real shortage of seats headed west. That's important information for airlines to take into consideration, including airlines like Allegiant who are flying to LAX, and right now it's scheduled to be seasonal and encouraging them to extend those schedules. So I just wanted to paint a picture for what we're expecting this summer, what we're planning for. We expect flights are going to be full. We do expect also that we'll be drawing from the broader region just because everyone is short right now. Any questions?
Angela, not quite part of your report, but I heard that or listened to a presentation of United standing up a new school in Scottsdale, or in Arizona, close to Scottsdale.
Yeah,
another
Aviate Academy, right.
Will that be attracting pilots with some existing hours, and that'll be trying to, what's their goal in kicking out new pilots per month or per year?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I can't speak to the specifics on that program, can you?
It's so I don't know what the turnout rate or the but it's an organic way of bringing new pilots into the system that don't necessarily come right out of the regional jet system. So it's a way to get kind of multiple pathways to get pilots into bigger planes faster, because the regional pilot community is being picked off today. And there's a shortage in regional pilots, so I think it's just to broaden the pipeline, to get more people interested in faster way of getting them to those seats.
Is it because they own that facility, can they get around the 1,500 hour minimum?
I don't know the logistics of how they work on the hours, but I think some of this really is, again, is just to get it to a bigger audience and to get people into the system without having to do it through the traditional methods, but I don't know in terms of meeting the minimum requirements how that goes.
It's actually $12.50.
Is it $12.50?
Now they lowered it a couple of years ago. Yeah.
Well, that academy also has a goal of really targeting underrepresented groups in the pilot community, and so let me follow up and get more information on that. I actually am good friends with the person who built that facility, so I'm like, oh, I know more about the facility than how it works. But let me get a little bit more information, because I think, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, they still have their huge flight training center in Denver. You know, they consolidated the Houston facility. This was a few years back. You know, this happened while I was at Denver. We were really competing because the Continental training facility was down in Houston. So when they merged, it was Continental leadership that survived. And so there was significant risk that it could move down there. I joked that it's a lot easier to get people from Houston moved to Denver than the other way around. Ultimately, you know, Denver was successful in securing that single facility. They doubled in size. And so that is a primary flight training facility. So I know that the AVA facility plays a different role, but let me get more information and come back.
Just be curious if it's beginning with, and they may not be the only one standing something up, if that's going to take this curve and shorten it a little bit where we see more actual bodies able to fly sooner than the traditional methodologies.
Sure, that's their hope. And that's where, you know, you see that hope and, you know, not a plan, but you see airlines trying a whole bunch of stuff because they don't have much to lose. But you still also hear stories of, you know, new pilots who have signed on with regional carriers who are being paid to sit at home because there's not a qualified pilot for them to go fly with. And so, you know, the hole's deep. It's clear.
And earlier, you may have mentioned this before, but I think I read or heard that the regional jet wage base is bumped up pretty substantially.
And not just the wage, but the sign-on bonuses. We've not seen anything like this in the last 30 years. And I think the facility in Tucson, in Phoenix, it's not a primary facility, so they won't teach you from private, but it's to take, there's essentially a foggy area when you get out of flight school with 250 hours. You need to find 1,000 hours somewhere before the airlines at $12.50 will take you. So you can go to work like our college here in town. We put them to work as flight instructors, but that only still takes you a year and a half. With Lufthansa and several Asian flight schools out in Goodyear, Arizona, they're seeing that done in 5 to 8 months.
Wow.
So I think that's the focus on that school, is they wanted to shorten that time so they don't sit and wait. Like the moment we had instructors at Colorado Mesa that hit 1,250 hours, they're gone. I mean, like that, it's a vacuum cleaner over on the other side of the hill. So if they can shorten that time from, say, 2 years or 18 months to 5 to 8 months, it's huge for them.
And that may help us recharge some of the flights that have disappeared.
Right.
Exactly. So that's where, you know, in our airline meetings, one thing was really clear. We want to grow here, and the current schedules don't reflect what they want to be flying today. And so as we're planning for the future, it's how do I still, you know, from their perspective, how do I still end up at this level at this point in time, even though right now I'm here? And I want to get there as fast as possible, so I help them with that.
Thank you for your report. Appreciate it. Sarah, any answer? Activity report?
So first, tonight, we just have the February 2020 individual payments over 100,000. We just had one go out, which was the release of retainage to United Companies for our taxiway Alpha project that the construction was completed end of last year. We're working with Colin and his team on writing up final reports on that for grant closeout at this point, because that project is substantially complete. And then as far as activity levels, as Angela mentioned, you know, we have those summer schedules kind of more firm coming out, so we can really look at that compared to budget, but we're tracking right on like amazingly close right now. You do see 2019 is the orange up here on the graph, and 2021 is the blue. So we've definitely seen some growth, and that's really load factor. We have not seen that capacity change much from last year, but those planes are a lot more full than they were in this first quarter of last year. Still not back to those 2019 levels, obviously, but a lot of that really is capacity driven at this point. So on track with budget so far, and that really reflects in our financials as well. This is just a snapshot of preliminary February operating revenue. Really the big contributor here this month that we saw was parking. Both January and February, the parking actually was performing at, you know, close or better than it was pre-pandemic. I don't know if that's an indicator of a return of business travel. We talk about business travel, and those early months tend to park more. We haven't really, you know, broken that down, analyzed it further, but definitely expecting or performing a lot better than we expected or planned in our conservative budget. The red that you see there in the under budget amounts in terminal rent and passenger landing fees, a lot of that really just has to do with the timing of how we looked at those incentives. And I think you saw that in your packet too. We really smoothed those throughout the year, but the way those incentive agreements are structured right now, the ones that we have, those will all be used up within the first quarter and a little bit in the second quarter. But our budget really smoothed that out during the year. So you're going to see that variance kind of drop off once those incentive agreements come out. So that's all we have for February revenue, unless I have any questions from the group on there.
Anything for Sarah on page one?
And then just to go back to kind of what was in your packet, just a snapshot for you just to look at for January, which is a little bit more final. At this point, we're ahead of our budget by about 80,000. Over in operating revenues, under in expenses at this point. Some of that's really timing. You know, we're not sure how to predict some of those expenses that happen at a not even pace throughout the year, but feeling comfortable so far and really excited to see that our non-airline revenue is performing much better. That's all I have for you this evening, unless there's questions from your pocket or anything else that you guys
are
doing.
Pretty concise report. You guys can let Sarah off this easy with just 2 minutes.
I gave you like 6 pages. Thank
you for providing those, Sarah. Appreciate that. All right. We'll move on to capital improvement plan. Colin.
Hey, good evening, everyone. I'll try to be quick too. We got to make up some time. Ryan went real long. So everybody's seen this before. The next few years is really busy with grading drainage and temporary nav aids. Big years. You can see the dollars. So in May, we're planning on starting the Cyan area, and currently Mead and Hunt is working on design of both the red dashed area and the blue dashed area. 7, and also the temporary NavAids. So I should have updated that to, you know, it's March. This is right. I think Sarah saved me, actually. Yeah, it is. So behind the scenes, that's really what this represents. There's a lot going on. Mead and Hunt started all of that work in January. We had a pre-bid meeting yesterday for schedules 3 or 4 and 5. That's the first package. We open bids later this month, and we're hoping that, we'll be able to capture a grant offer with that. The next package is 6, 7 in the FAA NavAids. That may actually become a second and third package. That's the way we're kind of being directed. We think it gives us the best chance for funding from talking to our FAA partners. But for now, we'll call it the second package. That's going to basically finish design in the July timeframe, and we're going to open bids and hopefully be able to capture some funding. So that's it for this slide, but the main thing I want to show you is what's upcoming. So we're talking about a whole lot of different things. We're talking about 2 and maybe even a third schedule going on. So far you guys have approved the grant to accept. You've accepted the grant for construction for schedules 1, 2, and 3. You've approved the contract for design for 4, 5, 6, and 7 in the utilities. You've also approved FAA reimbursement. So that those second 2 bullets are both money that we're committed to out the door, but we plan on recapturing the grants. So we expect those grants to start coming in the spring. So we think both of those will be covered in the April timeframe. In the meantime, as I mentioned, Mead and Hunt's working on that design package for 6 and 7, and we're going to open bids in March. So it's going to be busy. Long story short, in between, we don't know exactly when they'll come, but likely between April and June, it's a pretty busy couple action item months on things for the program. So it's kind of broad, but any specific questions that I can answer?
Just meaning a couple special board meetings for votes, essentially, or?
Potentially, I'm hopeful that focus on that. Well, I mean, we're being pretty communicative with our FAA partners.
There is one potential special board meeting we'll need, and you know, this is a better time to talk about it than in my report if I want to get through this. But with the building infrastructure, the building infrastructure law, the bill, as we call
bipartisan.
Yes, thank you. I'm like, that's not the right B. thanks. So bipartisan infrastructure law that was signed in back in December. There's money that's allocated to airports. We've talked about $5 billion in terminal funding, you know, spread over several years. And a portion of that will be available and prioritized for smaller airports. We've been waiting for the notice of funding opportunity, or the NOFO. That was issued, if Dan was giving this presentation, he would remind everyone it was issued late. He had to drop off, by the way. But it was issued late, according to the bill that was signed, but it was issued basically the start of this month. A 30-day window, you have to express your interest in applying for that grant funding. Long story short, it's really confusing. The airports are collectively very confused by it. Consultants who advise airports are confused by it, to not put words in your mouth. And the FAA seems confused on how it's going to work. So we are looking very seriously to say, should we be putting our hat in the ring this round or not, you know, what, and just trying to think through, what do we gain by that, what do we not? There will be additional opportunities to go after that funding that we know, and that's dictated in the law. But should we want to apply, still working with Dan on this, but we might need board approval of that application. And so, and there, the deadline is March 28th, so it's right around the corner, we know that. And we will keep you posted if we need you. We will call you. You do not need to worry about checking your email. If I need that, I will call you and say, hey, we think we do need this. We're obviously coming down to the wire. But wanted to give you a heads up. And you know, in case you're seeing it in the news and things, you're like, what does this mean for Grand Junction? Let us know if you know what it means for Grand Junction, because we're trying to figure that out. So, anything to add, you guys, on that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's just, it's the reason no one knows is because the FAA doesn't know. I mean, you can ask people at the FAA, but they do not know yet how it will work. It's not possible to know.
But there
So I think we're just sort of advising clients to engage their ADA, their local FAAs in a discussion and to try to figure out how their local, because that's what the guidance says to do, and try to feel out what do they think about it. But there's airports across the spectrum that are doing different things. Some are sitting back and saying, I'm gonna wait, see. Others are saying, I'm gonna throw two applications in, but people are really trying to figure this out. And unfortunately, it's a very frustrating time because it's just not knowable. You can't know yet. So.
The only thing I'd pile onto that is, I mean, we know you have terminal needs, and that's what this money would be for, but I think Angela's point is we're gonna talk to our partners at the FAA because we need them for a whole lot of things. We ask those guys for strategic advice all the time about what we should do to be positioned well. And I think this is just part of that conversation.
Yeah, and I've been thinking about it for like 2 whole weeks, so we'll talk with them later this week. So, we say this in a playful way because, this is just the state we're at, and our partners at FAA are good partners, and they're helping us as much as they can. And it's clear that it hasn't all been, it's just not set up yet. And so we're figuring it out. But the big thing I want you to know is that this won't be our only opportunity. We choose to apply this round. And that we're being thoughtful about what we think is most strategic and positions us to have the best chance to start building the stuff that Brian put before you, and specifically that orange box. In every alternative being considered for the terminal, phase zero is what it's called. So, in phase one, you notice how there was an orange box and then a blue extension. Building that orange box is the first step. And so it's nice because we have clarity on what we want and need to do. And so whether that is included in the application this year or next year, we think that, we're well positioned when it comes to that. The fact that we're in the middle of a runway replacement program does not help our chances of getting this money that's a different color, simply because we're already getting a lot of money. That doesn't mean that we're not going to work really hard to try to get some money that's this color too, but we are keeping in mind that context that we are recipients of a tremendous amount of grant revenue right now, and we want to be sensitive to the criticism our partners face too, and as they make decisions, that could factor in. They haven't indicated that, but they are planning to give us a lot of money. So more to come.
Additional questions for Colin?
Colin,
would you back up to the colored graph of our runway screw just a moment?
It's our favorite.
There we go. I'm curious, we hear about inflation going up 10% in the month of February. And as you look at this work, Mead Hunt primarily is the primary contractor on this. So we're not doing anything relative to asphalt and moving dirt in this phase, all design.
No, I got to think oil prices are going to impact it. Fuel prices are crazy right now. Who knows what they'll do? I don't know. We're going to see. I mean, we had four bidders at the pre-bid yesterday, potential bidders, and two that we think are likely to be bidders have expressed interest. So, at least there's a healthy bidding environment. I don't know. I guess we'll see. I don't like that approach, but
yeah.
It's kind of unprecedented, at least in my career. I've never seen it.
It's unfathomable unless you can get a contract. If you're the subcontractor looking to do the work, getting a fuel surcharge clause in there of some sort.
And the FAA explicitly.
And they won't let that. They won't let that happen.
Yeah. That actually came up in our pre-bid meeting, and
right.
I'm sure they all understood that it's bitter risk, and we get it. It's painful, but it's bitter risk, and everyone needs to understand that.
When you're doing those pre-bids and procurement, are you looking outside of the local area, or are you getting a diverse mix of?
Absolutely. I mean, Jeremy and I both make calls outside. We're doing this.
You're looking for folks who know how to do what we do.
Yeah, we engage the kind of community beyond just who sees it on, the bidnet and the bidding websites.
Yeah.
But the bidders yesterday were primarily from Denver, actually. This is a huge airport job. The equipment that, you can almost get priced out if your equipment's too small on a job this big. You just can't move dirt quickly enough.
Right.
Those are big pieces, expensive pieces of equipment,
yeah.
So it takes a certain kind of contractor to do it, and they count for
seem to see it a lot with bigger companies, not, I mean, the companies we're talking to, probably half of them. I bet United, Old Castle ownership probably has that similar structure, but I don't know specifically.
It seems like this is gonna drive that type of a contract, given the scope.
It's close.
Thank you.
Yep.
Anything else for the group here tonight? So, I had 6:55 was our closing time on my agenda, so we're kind of ahead of the game. I'm at the other stage. Any other business that may come before?
Maybe you lost an hour last week, so I'll be.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Thank you for all things to say. Really appreciate that. Unless there's any other business coming before the board, then we can make it for adjournment.
Second.
Moving seconded, any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Pose same sign, motion carries. Thank you for your attendance this evening.
Make a lunch.